Hello and welcome back to the History of the British Isles podcast. This is episode 49, The Rock, the Riotons and the Painted People. Welcome back to the show. This time we'll be covering what happened in Scotland after Rome no longer blocked off their southern border, as well as the beginning of the Christianising of Scotland. However, before we begin, I'd like to remind you all to follow me on Twitter, where I'm at BritishHistPod. Also consider joining the community Discord server. Both of those will be linked in this episode's description. Also consider making a monthly donation to the show via Patreon, which costs as little as $1 a month, and nets you a few rewards. If you want to make a one-off donation, you can do so via PayPal. Both of those will be linked in the episode's description. Next episode will be a Q&A, so if you want to send in a question, you can do so via any of my social media platforms or via email. My email address is historyofbritishisles@gmail.com. I'd also like to explain the name of today's episode before we begin. It's the rough names of a few of the kingdoms and people of Scotland. The Riotons is representing Dalriata and isn't a very accurate term. We don't know fully the context behind the name, but as we'll get to, Riota may have been the name of a person. Dal just means portion of land. So it translates more as Riota's land, not the land of the Riotons. The rock links the kingdom of Outclut, which translates as the Rock of Clyde. As we've talked about, the Painted People is a reference to the Picts. Now let's get on with the episode. Initially, the Romano-Britons were able to hold on to their power. However, sometime after 430, the situation began to deteriorate. Germanic mercenaries hired to stop raids had been around in Britain for a few generations, meaning they formed a substantial minority. They demanded higher wages but were refused. This sparked rebellion against the Romano-British, with the mercenaries who were tasked with stopping raids now raiding themselves. This was not a good situation for your average Romano-Briton, but this opened the floodgates for the Picts to raid deep into Britain. In a last-ditch effort to save themselves, the Romano-Britons sent a plea to Flavius Aetius, the most powerful Roman general at the time, for help. As with the one they may be sent to Honorius, the appeal was rejected. Aetius was fighting off Attila the Hun at the time, so no wonder he was unable to help a distant cast-off from the Emperor. Anyways, the eventual outcome of the mercenaries rising up was the slow Anglo-Saxon conquest of England. This is a really interesting topic, and I'd recommend you listening to the British History Podcast's episodes on this period, or, if you want something simpler and less accurate, listening to my episodes on it. The upshot of this was that Britain was being divided into semi-linguistic and cultural groups with a large degree of overlap. Bede described these groups as they were when he was writing in the early 8th century. He stated that there were five languages: English, the language of the Britons, the language of the Gaels, and the language of the Picts. In the Pennine Mountain Range, a line of mountains which goes vertically down from the Scottish border, kings probably began to emerge during the 5th century. We only know the name of one of the post-Roman kingdoms in the Pennines, Elmet or Elfed. Northwestern England stayed firmly in the hands of the Britons, while the east was a mix between Anglo-Saxons and Britons. In the 580s, four British kings, Urien, Riderich Hen, Gwalag, and Morkant, were able to besiege the ruler of the Kingdom of Bernicia, an Anglo-Saxon kingdom, on Lindisfarne. The Historia Britannorum reports, and I quote, "At the time, sometimes the enemy and sometimes the British were victorious, and Urien blockaded them for 3 days and three nights on the Isle of Lindisfarne. And during this campaign, he was killed at the instigation of Morkant because of his envy. So, it was infighting that pushed the Britons back. This seems to have been the last time the northeastern Britons held significant power, and in 592, the king of Bernicia, Aethelfrith, conquered the neighbouring Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Deira, as well as the northern British kingdoms." Bede writes that writes that he, more than all of the rulers of the English, devastated the British people. For no one among the military leaders nor among kings had made more of their lands tributary or more places for them to dwell, having exterminated or subjugated their inhabitants. The use of exterminated could either have meant slaughtered or, more likely, forced out beyond the frontiers. During the late Roman period, the Damnonii tribe of Clyde served as a bulwark against the Lesseronii tribe to their north and in the northwestern seaways. However, after the fall of Rome, these tribes turned their focus towards the defence of their own lands. This mess of Romanized influences self-preservation led to these becoming one of the first post-Roman kingdoms of Scotland. Their centre of power lay at Dumbarton, with their ancient seat of power being the previously mentioned Alt Clut, or the Rock of Clyde, from where they took the name of their kingdom. The kings of Alt Clut faced Gaelic-speaking neighbours in Argyll and the Inner Hebridean Islands. These Gaelic-speaking people could have been from Ireland itself, but it was probably more complex than that. The conventional view of the Gaelicisation of Argyll and the Inner Hebrides is that of the native Ipidi tribes being overthrown by Irish immigrants in Northern Ireland around the beginning of the 6th century, Bede records, and I quote, "In the course of time, after the Britons and Picts, Britain received a third people, that of the Scots, who came from Ireland under their leader Riuda, and one among the others, either by agreement or by iron seats that they still possess. From this leader they are called the Dal Riudni, for in their language Dal signifies part." The use of Riuda as the leader of Ireland contrasts with later sources, which refer to Fergus Mac Eoch as the leader of the Irish. However, both views are broadly consistent. Some historians have taken this as an indicator that it was, in fact, a fictional story. Indeed, Abbot Adomnan makes no reference to the Irish origin of Dal Riata in his Life of St. Columba, the saint who founded the monastery on the island of Iona in the 6th century. Adomnan himself was Irish, and he was a close confidant of Dal Riata's kings. It's possible that the stories of an Irish migration were designed to assert their independence in a time of instability, linking them to the Irish tribes who could have been raiding them. If this was the case, it's useful to talk about the Ipidi tribe. Ipidi means horse folk, and they were a semi-nomadic tribe of horse raiders. Now let's talk about what happened with the Picts after the fall of Rome. Gildas viewed the Picts as a major cause of the destruction of Romano British society. He records seaborne attacks intensifying after Honorius left the island to fend for itself. However, this is to be expected. We've seen throughout our episodes on Scotland that so far, whenever Rome was weak, the tribes of Scotland would come crashing down into England. Surprisingly, the Romano British were able to, at least initially, resist the raids. That only lasts until the middle of the 5th century, as we talked about earlier in the episode, where the floodgates opened properly. We've heard this whole story before, though. What's more important to consider is how the Pictish government evolved post-Rome. The legendary first king of the Picts was Cuthain, whose name is literally just the Irish word for Pict. According to legend dating to the 9th century, Cuthain had 7 sons, each of whom is credited with forming one of the 7 sub-kingdoms which encompassed the Pictish heartlands. We get most of our information about the Pictish monarchy from the Pictish King List, which names 60 monarchs who reigned up until 850. No kings mentioned on the list before 550 can be securely identified as real people. In fact, the only one before 550 mentioned outside the list is Wecraig Eötla, who may have been Feradach, a contemporary of the 5th century king of Munster, Conall Cork. The king list implies that there was at least one overking by 550. It seems the Picts were divided into two, with one overkingship in the north and one in the south. The one common characteristic which linked both zones of control was their language. It seems that it was distinct from nearby cultures such as Alt Clut, and as such has been described as a separate language known as either Pictish or Pictish British. One weird feature about the Pictish monarchy was its system of inheritance. And like literally every other monarchy in Britain and Ireland, the Picts used a form of matrilineal succession. This meant that the throne either passed to the king's brother or his nephew. In fact, no Pictish overking is ever shown as being succeeded by a son. let's move away from the history of kingdoms and talk about the early Christianisation of Scotland. After the fall of Rome, Christian clergy began to promote an idealised vision of a Christian kingdom to the post-Roman monarchies of France, Britain and the rest of the empire. Especially in France, many monarchs willingly converted to Christianity. The journey was a bit more complex in Scotland, though. There's archaeological evidence of small Christian communities across southern Scotland during the 5th century. However, there isn't much in the way of written records. In Galloway, there are a series of inscribed stone memorials commemorating Christian Britons dating to the 5th and 6th centuries. We don't know exactly when Christianity arrived in Galloway, but the first church of Whithorn dates to the end of the 5th century, at the latest, the beginning of the 6th. The man who founded the church of Whithorn was called Ninian, and he's an important figure in the early Christianisation of Scotland. Bede included a brief synopsis of Ninian's accomplishments in the ecclesiastical history of Britain, and placed him a long time before the much more well-known St Columba. It's likely Bede didn't exactly know when Ninian was alive, and except that he lived before Columba. Anyways, what did Ninian even do while he was a missionary preaching to the southern Picts? It seems he was pretty successful in doing this, and many Picts converted to Christianity. He also built the church at Whithorn. Excavations at Whithorn indicate that the church was built sometime around 500, possibly in the last years of the 5th century. After Ninian's death, Whithorn and his tomb became a holy site. Eventually, it was conquered by Northumbria and became an increasingly English holy site, as opposed to its Briton roots. Thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please leave a review for the podcast on our podcast or whatever else you can. It really helps the show. Also, remember that I'm doing a Q&A next episode and I want your questions. You can send me those through Twitter, where I'm at BritishistPod, message me them on Discord, or send me a message through Patreon if you support me there, or an email at historyofbritishisles@gmail.com. If you want to donate money to help me produce the show, you can do so on a monthly basis through Patreon or send me a one-off donation via PayPal. As always, I'll link everything I've just mentioned in this episode's description. With that, a big thank you to my $5 old woman patron, Emily Frias, and my $10 Duke/Duchess tier patrons, Anita Gardoni and Stephen Reinish. With that, goodbye.